He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think.
This is the School of Motion podcast. Come for the MoGraph, stay for the puns. Hey everyone, Joey here, and real quick before we get into this episode, I just wanted to tell you about our new motion design jobs board. Our mission at School of Motion is to help artists learn, master, and make a living in motion design. So to help out with that last part, we've built a jobs board that is comically easy to use for both companies and artists. If you're looking for motion design talent, give our board a shot and you'll be blown away by the quality and quantity of artists in our network. And if you're looking for full-time or freelance gigs, we've got plenty of those. So head over to schoolofmotion.com/jobs to check it out. And that's it. Now on to the episode.
I used to think a lot about that, like when I was first starting out, like, do I want to be a generalist or a specialist? I think it's funny how that just kind of happens. I think that just by working at a small studio, it kind of necessitates that you're diverse, you know, because like if the job comes in and you're the one that's available, like it would be great if you could know 3D, or it would be great if you could, you know, use After Effects.
Motion designers have lots of different backstories. Some kind of stumble into this field, some take a very deliberate path, and for some, this is a second career. For our guest today, it almost seems like fate that she ended up doing what she's doing. And what she's doing, by the way, is really great 2D and 3D design and animation. Tara Henderson is from the greatest state of Texas, my stomping grounds, and she started her MoGraph journey in high school. Then she went to SCAD. Then she moved to New York City, went freelance, worked with some of the best artists in the game, and now has come full circle back to Austin, Texas, and she's not even 30 yet. In this interview, you will hear stories from the trenches at the epicenter of MoGraph, New York City. You'll get to hear how even someone who's been successful, like Tara, has a bit of imposter syndrome. There's a lot of that going around, and you'll find out why turning down a staff job can really hurt somebody's feelings. So sad. All right, let's meet Tara. Tara Henderson, welcome to the School of Motion podcast. Thank you so much for coming on.
Of course, Joey. Glad to be talking with you.
I'm really excited because we do not have enough Texans on this podcast. So the first thing I wanted to ask you actually was about your portfolio site. Everyone listening, you need to go check out Tara's site because I think it's actually one of the most perfect examples of a portfolio site I've ever seen.
That's way too generous.
It's tarahenderson.com. We'll link to it in the show notes. But one of the things that I thought was really clever about it was on your about section, which has this hilarious like gif of you. I'm assuming that's you as a child dancing.
Yeah.
you have a section that you don't normally see on portfolio sites, which is, I think the way you worded it is, not my specialty. So you list all the things that you can do, After Effects, Cinema 4D, style frames, but then you have a section that says not my specialty. You're basically saying, don't hire me for this. And you have a short list. And one of those things that you don't want people to hire you for is lens flares.
Right.
I was wondering if we could get a little explanation there.
Sure. I mean, of course, that's kind of a joke. You know, everyone in the industry, lens flares kind of get a bad rep. A long time ago, they were super popular and they were very heavy handed. But I basically put that up there, I guess, to kind of like get people to know what I don't like doing. A lot of times, you know, people approach you with projects that you're not necessarily interested in. So, hey, why not just like put it up on my website, what I'm not interested in, to just kind of divert people from hiring me for that. There's a lot of people out there who are, you know, great at doing photoreal 3D and visual effects and, you know, lens flare type things, but that's just not my style.
Yeah, I think we're going to get into that later because, you know, looking at the work that you've put on your site, there is sort of a style, you know, I mean, you've got a lot of variety and you've got even some sort of photorealistic 3D looking stuff, but it's very surreal and kind of living in this stylized world. And it's interesting. So, do you actively turn down work if someone says, hey, we're doing a show open for Showtime Boxing and we want gritty photoreal boxing rings with lens flares? Like, you would just say, well, that's not my thing. I don't really do that.
Sometimes. I mean, it really just depends on, you know, how that client found me. But I found that just by like putting that up on my website, I'm not attracting those types of clients anymore, which was kind of my goal in the first place.
I think that's a good, it sounds like a good problem to have, to be in a place where you can start to really pick and choose which jobs you take, which, you know, I think for a freelancer should be the ultimate goal to get to that point. So we're going to dig into that in a little bit, but I want to sort of introduce you to the audience a little bit more. So can you tell us about your name? Cause I've never met anyone named Tara before and it's really cool. And I was trying to find out like if it was a nickname or something. Is Tara your real name?
Yeah. So it's spelled unusual, spelled like terracotta. Which, you know, there's a lot of people named Tara, like T-A-R-A, but I've always liked the spelling of my name. I don't really know why my mom called me that, but I was born right before the time that The Little Mermaid came out. And I have bright red hair. And my mom almost called me Ariel. So I'm really, really glad that I ended up being Tara instead of Ariel.
Okay. So it's funny because I have friends named Tara, like T-A-R-A, right. But I saw the E. And so I sort of subconsciously want to make sure I say Tara.
Oh.
But do you, okay.
No, I honestly
it's
don't.
Just Tara. Okay.
I don't hear the difference. I get called both. So.
Gotcha. As a total non sequitur, my middle child, Emmeline, has red hair also. So
oh,
I'm very partial to redheads. Okay. So, you grew up, and I only found this out by doing my typical Facebook Twitter stalking that I do for every guest.
Sure.
You're from Denton, Texas, which is interesting, A, because I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, about a half hour from there, but also because Denton, Texas, for people listening, you probably never heard of it. It's in this part of Texas that my mom used to call the boonies or God's country. And it basically just, when I was growing up, there's nothing there.
Right.
Yeah. And
Denton has actually, like, you know, when I was growing up there, it basically is a college town. There's University yep. of North Texas there, and Texas Women's University. It's pretty small, but I will say that in the 10 years that I had been gone from Texas, Denton has kind of had like a little, you know, mini renaissance, and there's a lot happening down there now. It's pretty cool.
That's what I've heard. Yeah. Our so Caleb, who works for us, he currently lives in Denton, and he's been telling me that. He's like, it's actually got a little scene.
Yeah.
There's some good sushi there. So how did you get from there to SCAD, to New York City, and back to Austin? I mean, you've had a pretty interesting journey and career. I'm wondering if you could sort of give us the cliff notes of how that worked.
Right. So I actually, funny, I'm from Denton because that's the closest town that everybody knows, but really I'm from a suburb that's on the outskirts of Denton. So I'm from the boonies of the boonies.
Nice.
I'm from a small town called like Dallas, Texas. At the school there, they had an electronic media course, which taught you how to use Photoshop and Illustrator, which was really great for like such a small town that they would have, you know, an art class that focused on computer work, which was not very common back then. So I kind of got into using Photoshop and Illustrator that way. And when I was in high school, I, you know, decided that I definitely wanted to get into design. So I started looking into design schools. And at the time, SCAD was like by far the cheapest art school you could go to in the South. And I noticed that they had a program that they had recently just like launched called Motion Graphics, Motion Media. So that really attracted me to the school. But even though it was like the cheapest design school in the South, it was still a really expensive school compared to like your regular university.
Right.
But I applied for a scholarship and ended up getting one. And so that's why I chose to go to SCAD, is because it ended up being the same price as a regular university for me. But
that's amazing. And so let's talk a little bit about SCAD.
Sure.
You know, SCAD obviously has an amazing reputation in the industry. You know, one of, if not the top, you know, motion design program in the country. I'm partial to Ringling's program also, but SCAD is incredible. A lot of amazing artists come out of there, but I actually know very little about how that program works. Could you talk about it a little bit? Like what sort of things did you learn there?
Sure. So basically SCAD, for everyone who goes in there, like your freshman and sophomore year is much more focused on like the foundations of design, like color theory, typography, those types of things. And then whenever you start getting into your major, you kind of start, you know, focusing more on like motion graphics or visual effects. I thought it was a great school. Definitely got a really good foundation in design, and I learned how to, you know, kind of present my work. I think that those were kind of the best things that I learned there.
Was there anything about it that you didn't like?
I kind of have mixed feelings about school.
I could tell by the way you said it.
Well, I have mixed feelings about school, but I think it's a critique on just all design schools in general. I think that they definitely could have focused a lot more on teaching the business of design. Mm. And, you know, I think that this happens at a lot of schools, is that some of the teachers are kind of out of the industry for a while. It doesn't make them bad at what they do. But, you know, I think that at the time that I went, they were just kind of a little bit out of touch with where the industry was headed.
So specifically, are you talking about things like how to get hired or how much to charge, stuff like that?
Well, I think that they even were more focused on kind of like the academic art focus of motion graphics, you know, instead of focusing more on like real skills that you would be using in the industry. I think also I kind of had mixed feelings about it because I started working whenever I was like halfway through school, and you kind of get this completely different perspective, you know, on the types of projects that you're working on in school. And some of them just felt kind of removed from what I was doing at work. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a similar experience in college because I started interning my freshman year and actually getting paid and stuff to edit and to do stuff like that. And then you'd go back to school and they wouldn't let me edit because I was only a sophomore and you weren't allowed in the editing lab until you're junior, stuff like that. And you know, I didn't go to art school, but it's interesting because there were similar conversations that came up when I taught at Ringling where I'm sort of unapologetically practical with the way I like to teach. I like to teach people things that they are going to go use tomorrow to pay the bills. Right. But I think there's also the argument to be made that, you know, school is a place to experiment and do these sort of art pieces and stuff like that. So was that kind of the tension you felt was, you know, doing these projects that weren't, there's no way you're actually going to get hired to do that in the real world. You're going to be doing explainer videos and logo animations, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there was a lot of focus, which, you know, is great. It gets you to try a lot of things. And so maybe there's something to be said for, you know, exploration and stuff. But as far like, you know, some of the projects that I would work on, you know, are kind of like, oh, do like a short, you know, like it was more conceptual and more like, you know, making something just for myself, which, you know, is great, but like, that's not necessarily applicable to like the workplace. Yeah.
did you see any, so I guess the end result that most students have, you know, in mind when they go to a place like SCAD is I'm going to get a job in this field. Someone's going to hire me based on my student portfolio. And did you ever see that not happening? Because, you know, obviously if you were working already, then you were kind of ahead of the curve. But did you have friends that, you know, graduated with a portfolio with a bunch of neat looking experimental stuff, but no one was going to hire them because they didn't have anything that looked practical?
Well, I will say that I think that a lot of my friends did find work in the field. So, I mean, you know, that's definitely to SCAD's credit. So I think that, you know, sometimes studio owners look at a kind of experimental reel and they kind of see a diamond in the rough and they're like, well, you know, well, we can give them practical, applicable skills.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think studio owners for sure feel that way. And, you know, I think that SCAD, probably the time you, what year did you graduate from SCAD?
I graduated in 2010.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I would imagine that in 2010, there probably were not a ton of students coming out of art schools with a deep knowledge of motion design. It was still very kind of new at that point. In 2018, there's more programs. You know, I can speak for the program at Ringling, like enrollment's growing pretty fast over there. And so I wonder if, you know, there's going to be a glut of motion designers trying to get into studios. And studios are run by artists who are capable of saying, oh, well, I can kind of extrapolate out how this experimental thing, you know, shows me the skills that this person has. But if you, you know, I think a lot of, a lot of graduates are going to be getting hired by places like Amazon and Apple and giant ad agencies. And I'm not sure that those places are going to be as good at that. Right. And so that having that practical stuff in your portfolio too, to me, seems important.
Yeah, I definitely would think so, in my opinion.
So how did you, so you go to SCAD and it, you know, it sounds like they have a great program there. So like the freshman sophomore year, you know, you're focusing on the fundamentals. You're not so much locked into software, which I think is really smart.
I almost would argue that they could have even focused even more on their design program, because that is what I got the most out of school, you know, was just those just design foundations.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I talk to, you know, my friends who still teach, you know, traditional schools, and obviously they know about School of Motion, and you know, like there's just reality that places like School of Motion and MoGraph Mentor in the future are going to become very viable alternatives to learn this stuff.
Absolutely.
But what a traditional school can offer that we can't is, you know, twice a week in-person critiques with 20 students and a faculty member,
right.
You know, and eventually we'll be able to do that too. But in the meantime, like, that, and so that's what I tell them. I'm like, you know, that's what you should double down on, is that's your advantage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Teaching somebody Photoshop, like, we can do that, you know, pretty easily, for a lot cheaper too. So, I want to hear, how did you end up deciding to move to New York and work? I think the first company you worked for was Elevation. How did that happen?
Right. So, you know, one thing I will say for SCAD is I got a great portfolio out of it that, I took to Elevation for an internship. I was still a junior, whenever I applied for that internship. And, you know, they hired me for the internship. I was there for about 2 months. And then they said, okay, let's just hire you full time, which was great.
Nice.
So I, for the last 2 years of school, I was working at Elevation as like kind of a junior artist. And then whenever I got close to graduating, you know, it had always been my dream to move to New York. And even though I love the studio, I didn't really want to stay in Atlanta. And so I talked to the studio owner, Stephen Cox, and he like very graciously offered to keep me on remote. So he said, you know, go move to New York, but, you know, we'll keep you on staff, which for me was great. Like, I mean, I think everyone knows how expensive New York is.
Right.
And just having, you know, a gig already lined up, you know, was just invaluable. And that was such a great opportunity for me.
I didn't realize Elevation wasn't in New York. That's amazing.
Right.
I mean, what a great gig. So, you said that it was always your dream to move to New York, and you know, coming from, like, I'm a Texan, and so I always sort of had a dream to go somewhere else, and I ended up in Boston. I'm curious why you chose New York.
I really have no idea. I guess probably just from movies. I had a great uncle who lived there, and you know, he had long since passed, but it was always just kind of something that had been in the back of my mind. My husband also had that dream, and I don't think he could necessarily define it either, but we both just really wanted to move to that city.
Gotcha. Did you meet your husband at SCAD or in Atlanta?
No. So actually I met my husband in Denton. He went to University of North Texas. So we met whenever I was a senior in high school, and we both worked at a DSW shoe warehouse.
A great gig.
So, yeah.
That's awesome. Cool. So high school sweethearts, love it.
Yeah.
So what type of work does Elevation do? I'm assuming a lot of people listening haven't heard of them. So what kind of stuff do they do, and what were you doing there?
Well, at the time they were specializing in, you know, broadcast work. So Turner is based in Atlanta. So is CNN. Yep. So they did a lot of work with them. They also did, you know, stuff with like HGTV and Oxygen and other broadcast networks. But they, at the time, they were mainly specializing in broadcast packages, you know, like show opens, intros, stuff like that. They have since diversified. Since I've left the company, they've diversified and, you know, become more brand focused. But great little studio. They do amazing work for such a small team. So,
yeah, that's kind of a trend I've seen. There's a great company in Massachusetts that I used to do a lot of work for called Viewpoint Creative. And they started, it sounds like almost identical, doing lots of graphics packages for HBO and Discovery Channel and networks like that. And then probably towards the end of my time freelancing there, moved more into that agency model where they also do general branding and copywriting and creative direction for giant campaigns and digital and print and all that stuff. So it's an interesting trend. And so you moved to New York City. You're still working for a company based out of Atlanta. How was that transition? Like, did you have culture shock when you got to New York, or did you just you fit right in there? Like, loved it?
Not really. I kind of felt at home there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was one of those people that never thought I would leave New York, but which is funny looking back now. But yeah, I loved it there.
That's awesome.
You know, I mean, just the vibrancy of the city, you know, just the energy. It's not really a definable quality, but I loved living there.
That's pretty much what everybody says that lives there. I spent a summer there interning. So I was there for about 3 months. And I really enjoyed it. But I have kids now and I could not imagine living there with children.
It is very difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine. So let's talk about your skills. So, you know, when I go to your website, the first thing that kind of strikes me is your design chops and you've like your use of color and all that stuff. Like you feel like a designer. That's how, like, that was my first impression. But you also do animation. You also use 3D and you seem to kind of, you know, looking at the credits of the work you've done, you sort of do a bunch of things. So I guess you're kind of a generalist. And I'm curious if that just sort of naturally happened or if at some point you said, I want to be a generalist. Like, how did that work?
I used to think a lot about that, like when I was first starting out, like, do I want to be a generalist or a specialist? I think it's funny how that just kind of happens. I think that just by working at a small studio, it kind of necessitates that you're diverse. You know, because like if the job comes in and you're the one that's available, like it would be great if you could know 3D, or it would be great if you could, you know, use After Effects. So I think that by working at a small studio, that made me a generalist. And then whenever I started freelancing, you know, that ended up being a really great thing for me because, you know, I can jump in on a variety of projects and I'm not really limited, I guess, to being a specialist.
That makes sense. I mean, yeah, I was kind of the same way. I didn't really design that much, but I edited and animated and I did 3D. And as a freelancer, that's like a superpower because you can just be booked all the time doing different things. And it's a really good career move. Did you ever feel like it held you back? Like you couldn't really focus on just design or just 3D because you were doing other things?
Yeah, I guess like whenever I first started out, I was much more interested in the design side of things. Occasionally, I'll still get booked to, you know, to just do style frames. But, you know, it kind of, I don't know, my career is evolving still. So who knows, in the future, I could just be designing.
Yeah, I'm always in awe of people who just design. You know, I've been really lucky. I've gotten to work with, you know, people like Brian Gossett, who, as far as I know, doesn't animate or anymore. Like he just does sort of designs and art direction, stuff like that. And it just seems effortless, like these beautiful frames just sort of fall out of them. Like, yeah. I wish I had that, but I never took the time and spent the energy to get there because I was doing like 15 things at the same time.
Right. Definitely. I feel like I'm in a similar situation where, you know, it's like, well, if I do want to specialize like that, eventually I'll have to start really focusing on something.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I'd say to anyone listening, like looking at your stuff, you've developed into like, you're good at all, everything you do, but you're definitely like good enough designer, good enough animator, good enough, you know, sort of stylized 3D artist that if you chose to pick one of those things and focus on it, I think you'd be successful. And I think it's probably easier to do that than to do it the opposite way and be just a designer and then say, now I'm going to start animating 10 years into my career.
Right.
And try to sort of reposition yourself on the market, you know?
Well, it's like I kind of I think that specialists, what, you know, there's the learning curve, right, for everything that you do. And specialists, they really ramp up and accelerate like one learning curve, right? So like if you're going to be a great designer, you're going to really just like get in there and you're going to get up to the top of that learning curve and then you're going to be at the bottom of other learning curves. Whereas like I feel like I've kind of approached it as, hey, and maybe it's just because I am interested in so many things, but, you know, I'm kind of still ramping up on all of the curves. So
it's more fun that way, I think. I mean, I could never, maybe there's like some form of ADD that some people have where, you know, like to focus on something for more than 3 months at a time is just too hard, you know? And to become a really good designer, I mean, you got to work your ass off for sure. I want to talk about 3D because I think the way we actually heard about you, Tara, was we were looking for female Cinema 4D artists to interview for our Cinema 4D Basecamp course. And we ended up like meeting a whole bunch. And looking at your 3D stuff, it doesn't, like when I say 3D, the image that pops into my head is not what you're doing. It's like this, you know, the photo reel shiny stuff. Right. And that's not the way you use 3D. It's cool. I mean, you use it more in like a designy way. And so I'm curious, like why that is, if that, again, is that a conscious choice? Are you not into the whole Octane X particles look? Is it, or do you just see 3D as another tool to execute like these 2D images that you want to make?
Yeah, I guess to me, I kind of see it more of as a tool. Whenever I was first starting to use 3D, like, you know, in school, like way back when in school, I was learning Maya and kind of, I took a couple of visual effects courses where, you know, you're like recreating a photo. And I found that like, there are people who are amazing at it, you know, and I have so much respect for people who, you know, dedicate themselves to that. But I guess I found it like really tedious because it's, you know, you have to be so focused on like such minute details. And I was never really interested in like recreating real life, I guess. And then whenever I kept working, like, you know, I'm very much like design focused in everything that I do. And so I think that whenever I started using Cinema 4D, you know, it's like, it's great because it can just be very quick and very, you know, get in, get out kind of thing. And I liked using it to kind of like add extra dimension to my kind of flat aesthetic, I guess.
Yeah. So eventually I got to a point when I knew Cinema 4D and some of, you know, some artists were sort of doing that aesthetic, you know, like the flat, you know, or tune shaded, or it just didn't look like 3D. And it was kind of like eye-opening to me that you could use 3D in a way that even, you know, like 5 years or 10 years before that, no one was really doing. And now it's everywhere. Right. And I think, you know, I actually encourage motion designers specifically to think of 3D in that way and not in the way of a visual effects 3D artist, you know, because I think it's kind of like anything. It's a tool to execute the idea, and the idea always comes first, you know?
Right. I think that so many designers, especially, are kind of terrified to use 3D, you know, because it seems like this big, scary thing, right? Like you have to learn lighting, you have to learn, you know, texturing, you have to learn everything all at once. And I think that the thing that's so funny about like the flat aesthetic is like, hey, just pop like, you know, a flat luminance channel texture on it, you know, and you're done. Like you don't have to light, you don't have to, you can approach it in a different way and it doesn't have to be that photoreal thing.
Yeah, well, that's actually how we've structured our Cinema 4D course because, you know, the thing about 3D, it's kind of like, I think learning 3D in a way, it's like learning design in that, like, with design, you have composition and you have color and you have, you know, like positive, negative space and foreground, you know, like you have all these concepts. And you can't just like learn one of them. Mm-hmm. Oh, I studied color. I'm really good at color. That's all I need. Now I can design. No, you can't. You kind of have, it's like a stool with two legs. It will just tip over. Right. You need to sort of have three legs. And with 3D, it can sometimes feel like, well, I have to learn modeling and lighting and, you know, camera and rigging.
And particles and, you know, and dynamics.
Yeah. Or I can't do anything if I don't know all those things. Exactly. And the truth is you don't really know any of that. And especially the way Cinema 4D is set up where you can just use it like a designer and just, you know, throw a frontal camera in there and make some cool compositions and use the luminance channel and boom, you get some really neat looking things that are easy to create, easy to animate. That's how I use it now more than anything else. For a while I got into the photoreal thing and trying to go down that rabbit hole, but boy, that's a deep rabbit hole.
Well, again, it's like you almost have to decide in your career, like what you're interested in and what kind of things you want to put your energy towards. And for me, it's just, it's not Octane.
Yeah, yeah. And who knows? Like, you know, there's the render wars. That's a whole nother thing you got to keep your eye on if you're doing that. Let's talk about, so I mentioned, you know, hey, spend a year, get good at color, as if that's all it takes. When I went to your site for the first time, actually, the first thing I noticed was your use of color. You have this beautiful project that is currently sitting at the top of your site for some lobby screens, I guess you did for Viacom. And just kind of scrolling down your page, there's just like really neat kind of use of color. And color is the thing that when we teach our design class is one of the biggest sticking points for most people. Like, how the heck do I pick cool color combinations? So I'm curious if you have any tips or, like, you know, any ways you go about doing that.
I guess for me, like, you know, I pull a lot of reference imagery whenever I work. You know, that kind of helps to kind of see what other people have done with their color choices. It's funny to hear you talk about color with my work because I feel like that's something that I'm always having to pull back on. I get a lot of critiques about, like, my work is, it's super, like, vibrant and very, like, the color choices sometimes are too bright. But I guess, like, somewhere that I sometimes start is I'll go to, like, colorlovers.com, and they have, like, kind of, like, preset palettes. And sometimes that gives you some ideas for, you know, where to start. Like, if you're thinking, oh, I want to use, like, you know, this particular color, you can kind of, like, see other color choices that people have put together. But usually whenever I'm working on frames, I do probably 3 or 4 color treatments before, you know, I land on one that I think is working best.
Yeah, the using the trick of kind of finding reference for color palettes. And, you know, I like to use, you know, Adobe Color and tools like that too, to help me. Do you ever feel like that's cheating? Like, sometimes I feel like I'm cheating when I do that, even though I know it doesn't really matter in the end, like, how I arrived at it. But I'm just curious if you ever feel that way.
I think that if you're, like, directly color picking from somebody else's work, that's probably cheating. but, you know, like, developing a color palette, like, everyone has their own process. So I don't know. I guess steal wisely, as they put it.
Yes. Feel like an artist, right?
Exactly.
Awesome. Cool. So another skill I wanted to ask you about. So before we started recording, you were explaining that you built your own PC and you moved from Macintosh to PC. And typically I find, like, you know, anyone who gets good at 3D tends to be a fairly technically minded person. And so I want to hear, like, why you decided to build your own PC and move away from Macs and stuff like that. Cause I've thought about it. But it feels like I'm just opening this can of worms. So why don't we start there? I want to hear about that experience. And you said initially it was to build a Hackintosh. It wasn't even to run Windows.
Right. So whenever I went freelance, I, you know, started looking at, you know, buying a Mac, and it's like, wow, Macs are really expensive. And on top of that, you know, like, not being able, they're a lot harder to modify. So, like, you know, if you want to upgrade something later on, it's kind of hard to, you know, to get that upgrade done without going to the Mac store and paying them to do it for you. So I looked into the Hackintosh community, you know, and I decided to build a PC that could run, you know, the Mac operating system. And I had never built a computer before, and I had, like, zero confidence that I could do it. But I will say it's not as hard as it sounds. There's, you know, just like any, you know, anything that you do in motion graphics, there's a million tutorials out there on, you know, how to build a computer and what components you should use. So, you know, that's how I approached it. And I ran Mac for about probably 3 or 4 years, but recently I just switched over to Windows, and it's been fine.
So, you know, when I was still doing more client work, and especially when I was running my studio, there was always this tension, like, internally of, I'm a very technically minded person. Like, I'm my talent, if I had one, was figuring out tricky, you know, After Effects setups, Cinema 4D setups. I felt sometimes like a technical director figuring out these tricky things. But what I wanted to be was that, like, really creative, brilliant designer type, right? And I had, like, some of that in me, but I think I was far more, I guess, left-brained about a lot of things. And so I'm curious if you ever have that internal struggle? Because you're, on the one hand, you're building a Hackintosh, and I know you said it was the first time you'd ever done it, but clearly you weren't afraid to do it. And you know, you've learned Cinema 4D, which is a technical program, but at the same time, you have this very, you know, kind of designer focused way of working, and your work's very beautifully designed and very creative. I'm just curious if you ever feel that tug between the two sides of your brain.
I think that, I guess for me, like, I, that's a tough question.
This is like Oprah. You can cry if you want.
So I think that, I guess for me, a lot of times I kind of hide the technical part of me, and I'm 100% a designer first, right? But there's things that I do technically that I kind of just like brush aside, like, oh, no big deal. You know, one would be building a computer. Another would be the fact that I do use a lot of expressions in my work. You know, I do know some coding. Like, I built my website on WordPress, you know? But I think that there's a tendency, I don't know if it's because I'm a woman, but I tend to be like, oh yeah, no big deal. You know, I actually don't know that much coding. You know, I kind of dismiss the more technical side of things. Whereas like, I feel like with a lot of guys in the industry, it's kind of easier for them, you know, to,
it's like a badge of honor or something, like, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's almost like a one-upsmanship, like, oh, well, I do this and I know this very technical thing about how to, you know, about computers and hardware and all this stuff. And I've just never, you know, thrown around my weight that way.
That's interesting. It's interesting because I always like to look out at artists and try to dissect success. That's kind of like my favorite podcast is the Tim Ferriss podcast. It's exactly what he does. I just try to do that for motion designers. And to me, success comes far more often from the creative, artistic side than from the technical side. But I anecdotally, yes, I've definitely seen that where, you know, for male artists, it's kind of cool that you like made this elaborate expression rig that, you know, like you could have just keyframed it, but whatever, you spent 8 hours building expressions. And I'm definitely been guilty of that. And then you go brag about it on Twitter, but you don't really see, you don't see females doing that.
No.
I kind of wish you would brag about it, Tara. I think that's cool.
Well, I think too that like sometimes the responses that I get are more just surprise, and it's like, all right, well, you know, it's more just like, oh, really? You know, you built your website on WordPress. Wow. Okay. You know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's something that we've kind of brought up a few times lately on this podcast, and I don't know. I feel like it's kind of silly, but I also, I don't know, like, have you ever felt pressured externally to do that? Or are you just sort of self-censoring?
No, I think it's just self-censoring probably.
Yeah. Well, I for one would encourage you to fly that geek flag as high as you can. That's cool. It's funny. We were actually, we're doing another class at the moment. I can't really talk about it yet. It's kind of a secret, but we were actually looking for, female After Effects artists who are pretty technically inclined and use expressions and stuff like that. And I can tell you it's a lot harder to find them. Because even when you put the feelers out and you're like, are there any female artists that are like this? And not that many raise their hand. So let's use this episode to say, fly that geek flag, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
The more the merrier. Yeah, that's awesome.
Tell everyone what expressions you use.
Yeah, exactly. You know, cool. All right. So let's talk about the freelancing thing. When and why did you decide to go freelance?
So I was working in New York for Elevation, you know, still staff with them. And I kind of was like, you know, wanting to, I guess, get to know the New York scene a little bit more. You know, like I was living there, but I wasn't really, like I wasn't working with a company that was based there. And I was going to the New York City MoGraph meetup, which is held like every month. It's hosted by two guys named Adam Saul and Yusuf Cole. And at the time, Adam was, he was freelancing as an art director over at Yahoo. And he was looking for a freelance motion designer who could kind of be like a permalance type position. And for me, that was kind of like the perfect opportunity to, you know, leave my staff job and kind of build a nest egg while I was freelancing. So
you wanted to go freelance, and this was kind of your you know, it was like a nice big net you could jump into.
Yeah, I guess it wasn't totally a conscious decision to go freelance, you know, like I definitely would have been happy with like another staff job. But I think that it was just kind of an opportunity that, you know, it's like opportunity meets preparation, or, you know, like I was definitely prepared to leave. And when Adam had this opportunity, it was just kind of the perfect fit.
Sure. And it was, I'm guessing, you know, more money, a change of scenery, you know, like, you know, maybe the opportunity to work alongside Adam. Were those all kind of playing into that decision?
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So it's interesting because you said that, you know, you didn't plan to go freelance. It wasn't like I want to go freelance. It was sort of like, oh, this is a cool opportunity. And yet I, you know, looking through your Twitter history, you had a pretty interesting little rant on there I wanted to ask you about. And I want to ask you because I've had this same experience when I was freelancing, and I forget exactly how you worded it, but basically you were talking about how sometimes you're a freelancer and the client that you're working with offers you a full-time gig and you turn it down and they get offended that you didn't take the full-time gig.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could just talk about that a little bit.
So it's funny because that actually did happen to me at Yahoo. They did offer me a staff position and I wasn't interested. Like at that point I wanted to, you know, start bouncing around as a freelancer. So it just wasn't really the right fit for me. Like I didn't want to be, you know, I had just gotten a taste of the freelance life and I didn't want to be tied down. But since I moved to Austin, I've experienced this a lot more. People are kind of a bit more, when you say you're a freelancer, they automatically hear unemployed. They don't really, I guess in New York, it was so much more natural to be a freelancer and like people kind of accepted that and they got it, you know, they got that you were running your own business. Whereas here it's, oh, well, you know, you're not really making, like they kind of assume that you're, you know, not making very much money, I guess. So they offer you this great opportunity, you know, what they think is a great opportunity, you know, to be staff with benefits, you know, and, you know, other nice things that they can offer you, like vacation time. And they don't understand that, no, I'm a freelancer. I would love to work, you know, with you on that basis. But like, I don't want to be tied down. I don't want to be staff.
Do you have any theory? I have a theory, but I want to hear yours. Do you have any theories on why people get upset that you're saying no?
Well, I mean, because, you know, they are offering you an opportunity. So I think that they feel that they have something to offer you and you're just kind of being blasé about, oh, well, I don't need that opportunity. You know, I think that they honestly do believe that they're offering you the best thing out there. And so they kind of feel insulted when you don't accept.
Yeah, I have a different theory. I'll tell you my theory. I think that, I mean, I obviously am way, you know, I am way in the bag for freelancing. Mm-hmm. I am a huge proponent. I wrote a book about freelancing.
I read it. It's great.
I think that, yep. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. So I think that sometimes people on staff, you know, in those positions of hiring freelancers, there's two things. One is there's element of jealousy, I would say, with the sort of perceived freedom and lifestyle of a freelancer, right? Like you can say, no, I'm busy and take 2 weeks off and drive around Austin, you know, hitting up kava bars and looking at bats if you want
Absolutely.
To. right. Which you should do. You know, so I think like there's that element. And then there's the other element of like, it is really hard to find good help sometimes. And you find a freelancer like you that's awesome and I'm assuming easy to work with and, you know, very creative, good designer, good technical chops. Man, it would just be so much easier if Tara just worked here and we'd have to keep booking her. And it's kind of like a hassle. There's a little bit of that too. So I don't know. That's my theory. And in my career, I've kind of been made to feel that a couple of times.
It's funny that you say that too, because I talked to a creative director recently in the Austin area who they're looking for people to hire. And, you know, they definitely voice that same frustration. You know, it's like, they're like, well, why would they go staff? You know, like there are so many benefits to being a freelancer right now that it's hard for them to entice somebody to become staff.
Yeah, I think, you know, honestly, this conversation is like part of a much bigger conversation with like the labor laws in this country and things like that. I mean, it's I could tell you, like, as someone who's run a studio and now a business owner, like the technology to work remotely and basically have anybody work with you from anywhere in the world, it's like almost doesn't make sense to differentiate sometimes between employee and freelancer, you know? And we've kind of evolved to say, okay, well, you know, I can use Uber to use the excess bandwidth that someone has with their car. So I'm sort of like optimizing the usage of that car. And freelancing sort of optimizes the usage of design talent and motion design talent, right? You know, if I have 6 months of work, I don't want to hire someone for 6 months and fire them. I want to hire a freelancer. And so there needs to be freelancers. I know we're not going to solve this problem on this podcast, unfortunately, but I have a lot of strong feelings about this, Tara. all right, I'll get off the high horse. So let's talk about how you get booked. So you're in New York and you're at Yahoo, and then does that booking end, or do you just decide, okay, you know what, I'm leaving this booking and I'm going to go find some other work?
That's funny. I actually, right after Yahoo, I went and became permalance at Viacom. But the opportunity arose in kind of a strange way, because Matt Hansen, who was running the Viacom screens department at the time, which was like responsible for all of the screens in the building, including like the lobby. They were kind of like ramping up to like get more content on there. But he reached out anyways, Matt Hansen reached out to me saying that he had gotten a recommendation from Michelle Higa-Fox, who runs Slantis Studios. He said that she had passed my name along. And it's funny because, like, you know, months later, like, I had sent her an email thanking her for, you know, referring me, because like I had never met her before. And she said, oh, well, I didn't do that. I didn't refer you, which was funny because, like, I guess either she didn't remember or maybe Matt had misattributed it to her. But later on, I ended up working with Slanted Studios as well. So, yeah.
That's awesome. So you've used the word permalance a couple times. I just want to make sure everyone listening knows what that means. So what does it mean to permalance?
So permalance is basically like a contract basis type thing where instead of, you know, being booked gig to gig like you normally would be as a freelancer, like you kind of come in-house and you're booked for, you know, months at a time. At the same company, just doing whatever projects they have coming in. So typically permalance is at bigger companies like Yahoo or, you know, Viacom, that kind of have the resources to keep somebody on staff and also have a ton of work coming in that they just need people to handle. So I did permalance at Yahoo and then Viacom. And then I started kind of bouncing around more, being able to, like, you know, go into different studios and stuff.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, like, how is it freelancing in New York City? Because it's, you know, New York and LA and maybe London, Chicago. I mean, there's only a few cities that are really just like the epicenters of motion design. And New York it might be the biggest one. So what's that like? I mean, is it like super competitive? Are there any disadvantages? Or is it like so easy to get work because there's just so many studios?
I definitely would say of course, just like anywhere in motion graphics, it's really competitive. But at the same time, I found it really easy to find work just because, you know, everything is so concentrated there. So you not only have like all of these amazing studios, which are arguably very difficult to get into, but you also have like all of these other really large companies that do need motion designers. You have lots of agencies, you know, you have lots of brands that need in-house motion graphics people. So I think that the work is just so concentrated there that it makes it pretty easy to be a freelancer there.
Yeah. And I know like Google has a presence there. I mean, there's got to just be like infinity motion design work there. And, you know, I've never worked in New York City, and I've always, like, at this point that ship has sailed. But I used to, you know, read Motionographer every day and see like, oh, another New York studio. Oh, another New York studio. Oh, another New York artist. And, you know, you must have gotten some pretty cool opportunities to work with some amazing people like one of my heroes, Erica Gorachow. So I'd like to hear how that opportunity popped up, and maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, Erica is, I mean, it's kind of weird. She's my client, but she's definitely one of my heroes too. I have so much admiration for her work. And I mean, she's not only like an amazing designer animator, but like, she's also a really like badass business owner, you know? So, yeah. I met Erica, through Michelle Higa-Fox, because Michelle actually, Slanted Studios has their space, but they rent out, office space to other studios. And Erica, is still currently renting an office from Michelle. So they're actually like in the same space. So I went and did work for Slanted. I met Erica while I was working for Slanted. And then later on, Erica had me come on to work with her on some projects. So
that's awesome. And so you were given one or two shots on the Dear Europe piece. And how was it working with, you know, the cream of the crop on that thing?
Well, so Erica like put that whole thing together. She basically, it was her passion project. You know, something that she, it was basically a message that she really wanted to get out to people in Europe to just go vote, you know. They had like a lot of elections coming up that, you know, had really far right candidates, you know, running for office. And so her message was just, hey, like, no matter what you guys do, just make sure you go vote, make sure that your voice is heard. So Erica had put a script together, and then she contacted, you know, just all of these amazing designers, I think through Twitter, and then just her own personal contacts. And then she asked me if I would want a shot, and I was like, of course. Okay. You know? I mean, like, that project had so many of my personal design heroes on it, and just to be able to do one shot for it was awesome.
And that's the kind of thing that I think being in New York, you know, it'd be very hard if you started your career in Austin to have an opportunity like that. And, you know, I always tell people that you don't actually need to live in New York or LA to have a good, you know, successful motion design career. But there are some opportunities like that that probably won't happen unless you're there. Would you agree with that?
I have. Yeah. I mean, I think that definitely, I probably wouldn't have met Erica in person, you know, if it hadn't been for New York. But I think that things are changing pretty rapidly. Like, there are some really great designers here in Austin. And I know that sometimes they, you know, they're building connections and their networks through Instagram and Twitter, you know? And so, I mean, yeah, New York is extremely concentrated, but people only have so much time to meet each other. So I think that just like through social media now, like, people are able to build those connections and kind of get those opportunities that they otherwise wouldn't have.
And you think even when you're starting out, you know, and you don't have a bunch of awesome stuff on your portfolio, that social media is going to be a powerful enough force to kind of overcome that geographic separation?
I think so, you know. I kind of have seen some people doing it here. I think that I am very guilty of not putting enough on social media, on Instagram. But, you know, there's people that are younger than me that are seem very adept at it, and they just keep, you know, working on their craft and putting up more work. And, you know, I think that whenever they do develop a good portfolio, and whenever they are putting out good work, that gets noticed.
Yeah, a lot of people say that now, that, oh, I don't do enough with my social media accounts. And when I was freelance, it was before that was kind of a established way of promoting yourself and of getting work.
It has changed a lot.
Yeah, and I know there's a lot of artists that's one of the primary channels they use to get work. So I wanted to ask you, like, how do you go about getting work? Because you've obviously got some relationships now. You've probably got repeat clients. But, you know, I look at social media, putting your work out there, that's kind of an inbound approach. You're relying on people to look at it and then contact you. But then there's also the outbound approach, which is what I talk about in the book, you know, reaching out and sending your portfolio to places. And I'm curious, like, what strategies do you use to get work, and what's worked well for you?
I actually, it's kind of embarrassing to talk with you about this because I have read your book and there's so many great things that you mentioned in there that I personally have not done. I think that I basically have built all of my contacts just through people that I've known. So I guess, like, I had a starting point and I've kind of worked out from that. Like, I have worked with people. I have done the best possible job that I could do on every single job. And I think that, that's how I've built my network, is just kind of like organically, like through referrals. So I have never been very good about, I guess, reaching out directly to companies and being more intentional about building my client list, which is something that now I'm trying to do a little bit more of. Like, I'm trying to seek out clients that I think I would design wise be a good fit for. But in the past, that's not something that I've done.
Yeah, I think it'd be very smart and probably pretty easy for you to do that because your work is good. I mean, it's all of the tactics that are in the book, they work if you're good enough, but you're like way past that. So they'll work really well. They'll work really well for you. Okay. So I want to talk about Austin too. Like, what made you decide to move to Austin?
I'm originally from Denton, which is it's 4 hours away. I had been living out of state for about 10 years. And my brother, actually, he made this video for his fiance that was like, basically, he took a recording every day, like 1 second every day for like a full year. And then he like edited it together and everything. And when he sent it to me, I kind of realized how much me and my husband had been missing. You know, like we would come back to Texas like once a year, but there's a lot of events that you kind of miss whenever you're so far away. So I guess like for us, it was more of like a decision to be closer to family. And my brother is a firefighter here in Austin, so it made that choice pretty easy for us. But I think that I had been living in New York for 5 years, and I think that me and my husband both got to the point where, you know, eventually we want to own property. And eventually we want to have children. And it just seemed really difficult to do it in New York. Like, you know, I have friends who have kids in New York, and I have a few friends who have bought houses, but they are much older than me. And it seemed like it was going to take a lot to overcome those hurdles.
Yeah, I think that's one of the best things about, you know, the technology we have now, is that you can work with anybody, but you can live in Austin, which... Well, Austin's not really cheap anymore, but it used to be, but it's way cheaper than New York. Yeah. But you could live in Sarasota, Florida, which is pretty inexpensive. Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, cool. And so it was basically for family, which I can totally relate to.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Has freelancing been any more difficult for you now that you're not in New York, or, you know, does it matter?
It's not that it's more difficult. I will say that I've been working less, but that was kind of my intention whenever I moved here. Whenever I lived in New York, you know, as everyone knows, it's very expensive. And I kind of always felt the need to constantly be working. So like I was always booked, you know, like I was booked all the time. And, you know, I would take time for vacation, but like definitely now, like I have breathers in between jobs, right? Which has been great. Like, you know, I work on a project for a month, you know, and then I take a week off, and it's been a great change in lifestyle for me.
And that's the reason that you turned down full-time jobs, that right there.
Yeah. Well, and I also think that, you know, whenever I do have children, like I think that that type of lifestyle will work great for that. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, why don't we end the conversation with this? Because, you know, I was going to ask you, like, what is your, you know, you've had like an interesting journey going from Denton, Texas to Savannah, Georgia, to New York City, working with Erica Gorachow. And now you're in Austin, kind of removed from that, you know, MoGraph scene, but still doing it, but working less. And you're talking about eventually starting a family. So I'm curious if, you know, have you thought about what your life looks like, you know, at that point, you know, like how do you get work-life balance? How do you want work-life balance to look when you have a family and you're still freelance, I'm assuming, and you have to now juggle working and diapers?
Oh man, like that is such a difficult question, because I know that there's people who are out there who do have kids, and they're just going to laugh at whatever my answer is, because I don't have kids.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot.
I guess for me, like, I just, you know, I want to have time to spend with my kids. Like, I don't want to have to hire a nanny, you know, which is what a lot of people in New York have to do. I think that I just I guess in 10 years, I just want to be better at my craft. I guess I would like to be at the level of like Erica, where, you know, I'm a director hiring other people whenever I need to scale up on projects. And I'd ideally love to have a little studio in my backyard.
Head to terrahenderson.com, and Tara, by the way, is spelled T-E-R-R-A, to check out her awesome work and to hire her if you want to. She's freelance. Just don't ask her to make lens flares. I want to thank Tara for opening up on the podcast and sharing some of her experiences and even some of her insecurities. I mean, we're all human beings, right? I think it's awesome when artists are super honest about the way they really feel, even when it looks like everything is rainbows from the outside. And of course, thank you for listening. I'll see you next time.